It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kerry Kaufman. Recent heavy rains in Wisconsin have left a lot of standing water, ideal breeding grounds for Wisconsin's number one flying pest, the mosquito. We'll start this hour of the Morning Show talking about this annoying insect and find out when we can expect them to just go away until next year. Michael Draney is professor of biology and chair of the Department of Natural and Applied Sciences at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. Professor Draney, welcome to the Morning Show.
Good morning, John.
Well, one seemingly nice thing about the end of summer typically is that there aren't as many mosquitoes. So what's typical about mosquitoes at this time of year?
Well, all mosquitoes, and first we have to say there's a lot of different species of mosquitoes, over 50 different species that sort of behave differently in Wisconsin, but mm-hmm. all of them have to find some way to get through the winter, and, none of them are strong enough flyers to fly south or anything, and so at some point they have to do something different to get ready for winter. Some species, the females, will overwinter as a mated female, and so at some point the females will get mated, but they won't lay their eggs. Instead, they'll wait until winter is over. And then other species, they lay eggs which have delayed hatching, and they have to go through a cool period and maybe through a dry period as well before they can hatch. And so those eggs are not going to hatch. They're going to overwinter. And so at some point in the fall, we stop seeing as many mosquitoes.
So some parts of the state have been hit by very heavy rain and flooding. Southwestern Wisconsin, for example, has had 20-some inches of rain in the last couple of weeks. What could that mean for Wisconsin's mosquito population?
Yeah, it really varies a lot depending on the place. And certainly, Madison area has had terrible mosquito season. They had a mild winter, which allowed more eggs and females to survive. And then that wet spring and summer allowed the populations to really build up. And certainly they're going to continue to have a bad mosquito season probably until things cool off. But a place like northeast Wisconsin, we had a really dry period in July and August. And what that does is really reduce the populations of mosquitoes. And so even when the rain comes back, they have to build up their populations, and it doesn't happen overnight. You know, it takes about 2 weeks or so for a generation to happen, and so if there's very few numbers, they have to go through several generations in order to build up really annoying populations. And then again, some species have life cycles which don't really allow them to respond very well. For example, some species have these delayed hatching eggs which basically have to undergo a dry period before the eggs are ready to hatch. And so, once it's wet, they're going to go through one generation and then just stay there. So some places are really probably not going to have particularly bad mosquito fall.
I live in northwestern Wisconsin, and we had that same dry July and August that you experienced in northeastern Wisconsin, and I didn't notice as many mosquitoes this summer. Also, it was very windy, and mosquitoes, as you point out, are notoriously poor flyers. I have to say I registered my very first mosquito bite of the year this past weekend, which is, I think, some kind of record.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great record.
So what's going to happen this early fall, September, and then maybe into next spring, how is all this water in southern Wisconsin going to impact, say, the hatch of mosquitoes when we get through winter this coming year?
Yeah, for some species, they're certainly going to, it's going to be set up for them to produce a lot of eggs that can overwinter. And we can expect, especially if there's going to be a mild winter, which, has been happening a lot lately, that's going to, set the mosquitoes up to be a problem next spring. But again, it all depends on a lot of different things. And certainly up in northwest Wisconsin, winter is going to come earlier up there. And so
thanks for that reminder, by the way.
Well, it has one good thing about it is that, it's not going to give the mosquitoes enough time. Not only do they need to prepare for winter, but the mosquitoes also grow up and start reproducing faster when it's warmer temperatures, right, because they're cold-blooded and their metabolism, responds to temperature. So as it's getting colder here in the fall, it's going to give them even less ability to build up populations that are annoying. So I think probably where you are, it's going to continue to be a pretty low mosquito season. That would be my guess.
Now, if we could just get rid of the black flies, that would be a big plus. You talked about the fact that Wisconsin has many, many different kinds of mosquitoes that call the Badger State home. What would be some of the more prevalent kinds? And you know, I guess from the perspective of someone who's being bitten, what difference does it make what kind of mosquito it is?
Yeah, you know, that's one of the things. Since there are over 50 species, some of them do not even bite humans, but many of them do. But the thing is, it really doesn't make that much difference to, you know, your average person which species it is. Certainly there are some species that are more active in the daytime and some more active at dusk or night. But, you know, as far as you protecting yourself from getting West Nile virus or some other disease, it's really best to just be vigilant whenever you're outside. So I don't really think it matters really that much to the average homeowner which species you're dealing with.
Yeah, so other than being vigilant, what can we do to protect ourselves against mosquitoes?
Well, you mentioned an interesting thing, which is that mosquitoes are very poor flyers and do not fly very well or attack very well when it's windy. And I often tell people that if you can put a big fan up in your patio when you're sitting there, you're going to really not notice many mosquitoes. So that's one thing that I oftentimes tell people is get some fans going.
So we're looking at, as the temperatures cool off, mosquitoes being cold-blooded, they'll slow down. They're getting preparing for winter, and any uptick we're seeing now because of all the standing water that's around Wisconsin, particularly southern and southwestern Wisconsin, once the temperatures cool off, the water won't make as much difference, and we can expect to see mosquitoes go away. Is that a fair summary?
Yep, that's right. I mean, some of them are already done. You know, there are some species that only reproduce in the spring and the early summer. There are some species that are laying eggs right now, but they can't hatch because they need to dry out first, and that's not going to happen before fall. And even the ones that are really pesty, there's some species that we call rain pests that will have many generations, and if it rains, there'll just be more of them. Even those ones are going to be gone as soon as we have a hard frost. As soon as it gets below about 25 degrees, even one morning, you probably won't see any more mosquitoes after that.
You mentioned West Nile. That's certainly a mosquito-connected disease. What other diseases do mosquitoes carry, and which ones do we need to be concerned about here in Wisconsin?
There's a number of different diseases. I think West Nile is one that is easily communicable and is a real problem. But there are some other things that are sometimes a problem. I would say that they tend to be more of a problem in the summer, and so I'm hoping that our mosquito disease season is largely over by now. But I still would recommend that people be vigilant and wear DEET and stuff like that.
Okay. And maybe a long sleeve shirt and long pants instead of shorts and a T-shirt?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, that's what I always do is wear clothes. That's the most effective protection against mosquitoes.
One of my retirement goals is to wear shorts 12 months a year, so that's not going to work for me. But I'll have to rely on the breezes we get up here in northern Wisconsin. Michael Draney is a professor of biology and chair of the Department of Natural and Applied Sciences at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. Michael, thank you so much for joining us this morning on The Morning Show.
Yeah, thanks. It was a pleasure.
I'm John Munson, in for Kerry Kaufman. More of The Morning Show to come after a short break. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. John Munson in for Kerry Kaufman. Suicide is a leading cause of death in the United States. Approximately 41,100 Americans kill themselves every year. The number of suicide attempts is much greater than that. September is National Suicide Prevention Awareness Month, and a good time to raise awareness, talk about risk factors, warning signs, and ways to help. We'll also take a look at suicide as a public health challenge. How has suicide affected you or your loved ones? How has it affected your community? Have you considered or attempted suicide? What would you like people to know about risk factors, warning signs, and ways to help? What are you or your community doing to prevent suicide or raise awareness? And what questions do you have about suicide prevention, risk factors, warning signs, and ways to help? Here's how to get in touch. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas@WPR.org is the email address, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. I'm joined this hour by Leah Rolando, suicide prevention specialist at Mental Health America of Wisconsin. Leah, good morning and welcome to the morning show.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Suicide is a public health problem. Give us a sense of how the suicide rate has changed in our country in recent decades.
Yeah. So according to the CDC data, if folks aren't familiar with the CDC, that's the Centers for Disease Control, we know that 45,000 people were lost to suicide in 2016, and that's an increase in most states and groups. And then also the new data that just came out says that more than half of people, or about half of people, have no mental health diagnosis at the time of their death. So that, you know, that speaks to the ongoing realization that this is a public health challenge and not just, you know, something to be addressed in a clinical setting.
Mm-hmm. The fact that that high a rate of people who haven't had any kind of mental health problem diagnosed, does that suggest that we need to do a better job of diagnosing mental health issues, or is there something else going on here, do you think?
I don't know if it speaks to needing to do a better job diagnosing, but it speaks to needing to recognize that suicide prevention is kind of everybody's business, and that it's not up to just a clinician to notice if somebody might be struggling. So it could mm-hmm. be a family member or a coworker. So people who aren't in clinical settings, who aren't currently receiving services, might also be considering suicide. So speaking mm-hmm. to, we need to just address it directly and ask folks if mm-hmm. they're thinking about suicide.
Okay. What about here in Wisconsin? What are the suicide rates here? Are we seeing a similar trend to what's going on in the rest of the country?
We are. Our increase is about 19% to 30% increase in the last. So that's 1999 to 2016. So about in the middle. We know all states, except for one, have increased rates, but Wisconsin's pretty much on par with the national average mm-hmm. of that increasing.
Now, we know suicide happens across all age, economic, social, and ethnic boundaries, but are there some groups where the rate is higher?
Yep, there is. So we know that a group that's not talked about a lot when we talk about suicide prevention is men in their middle years. So that age group, and you know, we talk about how do we reach men? How do we normalize the conversation about mental health and suicide and just general well-being for men in their middle years? And we also know, because of some current YRBS, so Youth Risk Behavior Survey data from 2017. Students who are LGBTQ or are experiencing homelessness, and then students of color, students with disabilities, are at higher risk for thinking about suicide and also attempting. So that data helps us know how to target efforts to certain groups and who to be paying attention to.
What do we know about suicide reporting?
Well, we definitely know that it's likely that suicide is underreported, and across all groups as well. But really, if a family member does die by suicide, and the family isn't ready to publicly address that as suicide, it doesn't get recorded or reported. So we know that the numbers might be higher.
So the number of actual suicides are, there's a good chance that there are more happening than we know about simply because these don't get reported.
Correct. Yeah. And I, yep. go ahead.
No, you know, go ahead.
And we know we have efforts across the state working with you know, medical examiners and coroners to make sure that the correct questions are asked and that we do get the correct numbers so that we know who's actually at risk and who's actually dying by suicide so that we know how to, you know, again, target our efforts.
Mm-hmm. Leah Rolando is a suicide prevention specialist at Mental Health America of Wisconsin, and we want to hear from you. We know that suicide happens among all groups of people. So how has suicide affected you? What about your loved ones, your community? Join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. or tweet at WPR Mornings. A moment ago, we talked about the different groups of people, socioeconomic, age, a number of other factors where suicide is more prevalent or less. Do we think, for example, a middle-aged man, is there some kind of issue here with increased depression? Are we finding more men diagnosed with depression at that age, or what's going on there with them?
Well, we know when you think about, you know, traditional gender male roles, and you think about divorce as something as a contributing factor to suicide, or job loss, or a physical health problem. So when you think about those factors, you know, happening to middle-aged men, that's a loss. So any transition or any loss can put someone at risk for suicide.
What are some some risk factors that may increase the likelihood of attempting to or dying by suicide?
Yeah, definitely, like I mentioned, divorce. That could even be a relationship problem. It doesn't even have to be, you know, marriage and then divorce, but a relationship problem, problematic substance use, so alcohol or any other drug misuse, mm-hmm. a job or financial problem, loss of housing, really any transition. Transitions are not talked about a lot in terms of what we can do for prevention. We could really target our prevention efforts for folks in transition. And that could be in any of those factors that I mentioned.
So how has the way we talk about suicide changed? Is there a sense that the stigma on these conversations is lessening?
Yeah, I'm not sure of the data, but I'm hopeful and I'm optimistic that the stigma is decreasing. And again, my position is suicide prevention specialist, so I work with people who are passionate about suicide prevention. And in my circle, at least, you know, people are talking about stories of recovery and talking about supporting people who have lost loved ones who have died by suicide. So in my experience, I've definitely seen a decrease in stigma. And it seems like even reporters and journalists are doing a much better job at reporting on suicide and talking about resources and hope and recovery and stories of lived experience rather than suicide, you know, as a crisis or being graphic and explaining any suicide death. So I'm hopeful.
How is the language changing when it comes to how we talk about suicide?
Yeah, that is such an important question and really not talked about enough. So we know there's so much stigma around suicide, and so problematic terms that are still kind of used to discuss suicide would be committed or successful or unsuccessful, even saying completed suicide. And some of those are problematic because they just add stigma, especially commit. We try not to say commit because that's associating suicide with a crime or a sin and is really stigmatizing that person who is thinking about suicide and also harmful to the family as well. It, you know, it further excludes them from their community. So, you know, the really helpful language would be died by suicide, lost someone to suicide, even died of suicide. In using the word suicide directly and not being afraid to talk about it. And I know that's easy for me to say as a suicide prevention specialist, but The more we normalize the conversation and are unafraid to ask people how they're really doing, I think the more we have an opportunity to get folks the help they need.
I want to take a moment and share the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, 800-273-8255, which offers free and confidential support for people in distress. 800-273-8255, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. We're talking with Leah Rolando of Mental Health America of Wisconsin about suicide prevention. This conversation will continue after the news. I'm John Munson. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Carrie Kaufman. September is National Suicide Prevention Awareness Month and a good time to raise awareness, talk about risk factors, warning signs, and ways to help. We'll also look at suicide as a public health challenge. And we want to hear from you. We know that suicide happens among all groups of people. How has suicide affected you? What about your loved ones and your community? You can call us to join this conversation at 800-642-1234, email us at ideas@wpr.org, or tweet at WPR Mornings. My guest is Leah Rolando, suicide prevention specialist at Mental Health America of Wisconsin. And we have a caller on the line. Tom is with us from Burlington. Tom, good morning. Thank you for joining us on The Morning Show.
Today is one of the most infamous suicide days of all days in our history. It's 9/11, when the suicide bombers took the airplanes and crashed them into the Twin Towers in New York. And I wrote a song about it, and they put it on a memorial in Wales, Maine, and President Bush, George H.W. Bush, went there and prayed, and he sent me a picture. And then I finally put the song out yesterday, and you can Google Boyle Sings Mother Liberty if you want to hear it.
Tom, we thought you wanted to talk about some suicides in your community's high school this year. Do you want to talk about that, please?
Yes. In Burlington, we had a suicide in July, and we had another one in August. One was a graduate from Burlington High School, and the other one was a student in Burlington High School. And the thing is, there was really no mention of it in the newspaper. It's something we don't seem to talk about. And this thing is, I don't know if we're toughening up our kids enough so that they can take the ups and downs of living. And if you lose the will to live, once the will to live is gone, it seems it's gone, and people have a death wish or something. I don't know if you can maybe explain that.
Sure. Tom, thanks so much for your call. Leah Rolando, if someone has lost the will to live, how do they get it back?
Yeah. Thanks so much for calling in. We know that, especially with depression or other types of mental illness, one of the symptoms is hopelessness. It's feeling hopeless and that really it's not going to get better as many times as you can hear it. And all you can do is continue to rally around those people and remind people of their worth and that they're loved, and make sure that they have access to services. So really on a personal level, you know, if that person has a support system and that support system can really fight with that person to continue staying alive and continue to believe that tomorrow can be better, there is still hope that they don't have to die by suicide. And again, sometimes there really aren't warning signs that you see. Sometimes there's things that folks miss. And again, that speaks to us as a community needing to do better and to be there for people in a really intentional way. But it's hard.
Mm-hmm. Again, I want to mention the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline number. We mentioned it earlier. I'm sure it'll show up in on the web connected to this program. 800-273-8255. 800-273-8255. Speaking of phone numbers, we have another caller waiting to join us. Let's go to Mike in Madison next.
Well, hi. I'm 68 years old, and I have a brother who died by suicide about 9 years ago. Twin brother, identical, and there's a couple questions I had, but it's still hard to think of memories of our growing up and stuff, and we had so much fun together, and how that all happened. He had a very good life. He contributed to society in a number of ways, including working for the National Weather Service, helping in flood predictions. In fact, that's what got him into trouble was when he started talking about the effects of global warming on flooding. But anyway, my question was the drugs people get prescribed for dealing with this problem seem to almost precipitate the feelings of having to do the act. And I'm wondering, sometimes their warnings are only for children. It seems like those are also applicable to adults. And also my brother had a real fear of going back to the hospital. He was there once for trying to do it. And that also, I think, drove him to want to end things.
Mm-hmm. Mike, thanks for that call. Leah?
Yeah. There's a lot in there. So, again, I appreciate you calling in, and I'm so sorry for your loss. And that speaks to a lot of folks who have lost people to suicide still feeling that pain. It doesn't matter how long it's been. It's still really hard.
What about Mike's point regarding a lot of the drugs that are prescribed as antidepressants? A lot of them carry warnings that these drugs may produce suicidal thoughts.
Yeah, that's definitely an issue right now. And I'm not a clinician, and so I can't speak to, I don't know how to, you know, diagnose and prescribe medications, but that's an opportunity for the work that we're doing with healthcare systems throughout Wisconsin through our Zero Suicide Initiative to make sure that safety nets are stronger for those people. So if there's a medication that does increase thoughts of suicide, making sure the follow-up with that person is immediate and consistent, and making sure they're on medication that doesn't, you know, increase those suicidal thoughts.
Mm-hmm. I'll just go public with this here. I have been myself treated for a form of depression called dysthymia since about 1999 and have taken a variety of medications, some with greater or lesser effectiveness. So I do have some experience with this, it can be a real issue for people who are suffering from depression trying to find the right kind of treatment. We had Brian in La Crosse calling in this morning to ask, other than socioeconomic factors, are there other factors that doctors may be able to screen for, so to speak, like if someone has a genetic history or predisposition for depression or something like that? Wouldn't that help us to determine who might be more at risk for suicide?
Yeah, absolutely. When I talked about risk factors, I was talking broadly, and that was some of the stuff from the CDC report, but you would definitely be screened for prior suicide attempts, because we know that can put someone at risk. Problematic drug use or a genetic, if you do are diagnosed with a mental illness, particularly depression or other mood disorders, and then knowing someone in your family who's died by suicide or someone you were close to can also put you at risk.
One of the things that has kind of, I think, changed over the years is the amount of contact that people actually have with their primary healthcare professional. My primary doctor is somebody I see once a year. I might engage with specialists other than that, but I really, for most of us, the only time we see our primary care physician is when we have an annual physical. How does that play into all of this, particularly in the area of screening?
Yeah, it's difficult because, you know, you only go in when, you know, if there's something major wrong or your regular screening like you talked about. So that Zero Suicide Initiative I was talking about is the goal is to equip clinicians and doctors, primary care providers, with the tools and the knowledge about suicide, about how to ask these questions, about how to do better follow-up, in the hope that, again, that safety net is tightened for people, mm-hmm. and that there is more follow-up than there has been. And we know that it's hard when, you know, providers have so many patients, and sometimes another thing to just check off seems like a lot to do, but it's so important when it can mean the difference between life and death. So mm-hmm. I really see a lot of hope in this zero suicide movement and organizations, healthcare organizations, getting trained to normalize the conversation and to really do good follow-up with the patients that they serve.
During this conversation, we've shared the number for the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, 800-273-8255. Broadly, walk us through what happens when someone calls that line.
Yeah, great question. So, you know, we see that number everywhere, and we know that it's the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. So when someone calls it, and they are, you know, they'll route it to the county, and then the county, depending on what services are available and how high risk or imminent risk the call is, they can route it to crisis services. So sometimes, you know, it could be someone calling because they're concerned about a loved one, and so they wouldn't need to route it and, you know, have crisis services come, and they can just talk them through what that person might do and what they could do in their own community. Mm-hmm. But if a person does, you know, answer yes, do they have a plan, they've thought about ending their life, and that they have, like, started doing something to end their life, they would route it to county services, and then dispatch whoever the most appropriate crisis team would be.
When should someone call 911 instead?
When a person has told you that they've thought about killing themselves, when they've told you that they have a plan, and when they tell you they have a time frame, so they told you, like, I'm, you know, going to end my life tonight, or I have a plan for tomorrow or something. So when they're imminent risk, you would want to contact crisis services or 911.
All right. We're going to continue this conversation in just a moment. Leah Rolando is my guest. She is a suicide prevention specialist at Mental Health America of Wisconsin. We're talking about suicide this morning on The Morning Show, and we'll continue this conversation in just a moment. John Munson in for Carrie Kaufman. This is the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. John Munson in for Carrie Kaufman. This is National Suicide Prevention Awareness Month, a good time to raise awareness, talk about risk factors and warning signs, ways to help. And we'll also be talking about suicide as a public health challenge. We'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or tweet at WPR Mornings. My guest is Leah Rolando, a suicide prevention specialist at Mental Health America of Wisconsin. So at the community level, what can communities do to aid in suicide prevention?
Yeah, great question. There's so much, and depending on your community, depending on if you have a suicide prevention coalition, you can intervene at multiple levels. So let me give some context to the suicide prevention coalitions. For example, on our PreventSuicideWisconsin.org website, we have a list of county coalitions. So you can look at the map for Wisconsin and look if your county has a community or has a county coalition for suicide prevention. And if it doesn't, there's ways to connect with neighboring coalitions or even start your own. And so those coalitions do a variety of things. Some, since it's September, a lot of them are doing the walks. We do a lot of walks for suicide prevention to raise money for people getting access to services or suicide prevention research, a variety of things in their own local communities.
If someone's interested in getting involved in that, how do they reach out? How do they get in touch?
Yeah, so they can go directly to the PreventSuicideWisconsin.org website and look at that coalition tab that we have, and then the contact information for each coalition leader is actually on that list. And then if for some reason they can't get in touch with that coalition leader because of, you know, a transition or something, they can definitely reach out to me at the general PSW, so that stands for Prevent Suicide Wisconsin, so PSW@MHAWisconsin.org, and then I can connect them with maybe a neighboring coalition or walk them through the steps that it would take to get involved.
So we can join a coalition and work in our communities. What are some other things we can do locally across Wisconsin to aid in suicide prevention?
So the work that our coalitions do is informed by our overall Wisconsin suicide prevention strategy. So their work can fall under four different goals. So goal one is actually increase and enhance protective factors. And so some activities that fall under that is working with schools and youth to reduce the impact of adverse childhood experiences. So making sure there's trauma-informed care in schools and other education facilities, and then increasing social connection. So even things as simple as starting a book club. Our local coalition in Milwaukee is doing starting up a book club to gather people together and talk about suicide and talk about hope and just bring people together, because we know that social connection, that human relationship, is really like the most important thing in suicide prevention. So that's mm-hmm. just one example of something coalitions can do.
Let's take another phone call. We'll go next to DePere, where Aaron is waiting to join us. Aaron, good morning. Thanks for joining us on The Morning Show.
Hi, good morning. Thank you. I just wanted to say thank you so much for bringing up ACEs in your last comment. That's what my question is about. How much does the current suicide research think of suicide as a like problem that has symptoms versus a symptom of the greater problems being like child neglect and child abuse and drug abuse and, you know, like history of mental illness in your family and all of those ACEs, you know, once they add up, we know that they do lead to suicide and depression and terrible health effects. I'll take my comment. I'm good.
All right, Aaron, thanks for the call. Leah, what about that?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Suicide is definitely a symptom of those things, even if it is not a diagnosed mental health condition. Trauma totally plays a role in someone deciding to end their own life or having suicidal thoughts. And so there's a lot of research out there. I'm not sure what to exactly cite right now, but I know folks at DHS are working on this connection between trauma and suicidal thoughts, and most importantly, resilience. So working with youth and adults as well on how to create safety plans and plans that just have resilience built into it. So what can we do to increase resilience in youth? So that's a huge conversation happening right now, and I really appreciate you emphasizing that and calling it. So thank you.
Aaron, thanks so much for that call. How are we addressing suicide prevention as a state? How's Wisconsin doing with addressing suicide prevention? And what do you hope for in terms of the future here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so I cited our suicide prevention strategy. So we actually just had a steering committee meeting on last Friday, and so we have. Through DHS, we receive some funding to address suicide prevention on a state level. And so that's my position with Mental Health America, is to coordinate this steering committee and work with folks across the state to better target our efforts. And so we're working on updating the strategy looking into more funding so that there are opportunities in communities that don't have a ton of access to services, because we know that access to services, access to mental health services, is really key in getting people the help they need. You know, you can tell someone to get help if they need help, but if the help isn't there in the form of services or, a counselor or a therapist, it's difficult to say that. So we can definitely advocate for funding for services and increased funding for coalitions to do the work that they can do, because a lot of our coalitions are volunteer, and so having maybe a staff person on a coalition to be able to lead these efforts is also really important.
So how can we become more, how can we change the way we think personally if we say we have relationships where somebody's at risk? What kinds of things that do we need to be doing if that's our situation?
Yeah, just, I know I keep saying normalizing the conversation, because that's so important. So talking to people and addressing that, it is uncomfortable to talk about suicide. It is scary, but we've got to do it. We've got to talk about what makes people hopeful. A really big campaign through a suicide prevention organization that I really love, their campaign slogan for World Suicide Prevention Day yesterday is "Tomorrow Needs You." And so really elevating the conversation about hope and recovery and that it can get better, but having those personal conversations. So rather than just posting on social media, which we can do, talking to people about what gives them hope and what you stay alive for, and not being afraid to have that conversation.
We're just about out of time. I really want to make sure we get to the resources that are available to people when it comes to suicide prevention.
Yeah. So you mentioned the Lifeline a lot, which is awesome. So that Suicide Prevention Lifeline. And they also have an amazing website. So if folks just know it as the number, I would encourage people to look at their website and check out the different resources that they have. We also have the keyword partnership with the Crisis Text Line in Wisconsin, and that's Hopeline. So all you would do is text the word Hopeline to 741-741, and you would be connected with a Crisis Text Line volunteer who, if you're in crisis, you can talk with them, and the goal is to bring you from a really hard moment to a cool calm. That's available, and it's free, and it's 24/7 to anyone.
Okay. Well, we're about out of time. I do want to mention that there is a list of links on WPR's page, The Morning Show, about this topic. And we also just tweeted a link to the page. So there you go. Leah Rolando is a suicide prevention specialist at Mental Health America of Wisconsin. Leah, thank you so much for this hour. And again, the phone number for the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 800-273-8255. I'm John Munson in for Carrie Kaufman. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.